What role do the families we're born into or the traumas we experience shape the people we become? Do good deeds offset bad deeds? How can the arts increase our capacity for empathy, understanding, and kindness?
Dan Futterman is creator, executive producer, and writer of Amazon Prime's American Rust, the acclaimed crime drama starring Jeff Daniels, Maura Tierney, and David Alvarez. Previously, Dan has written screenplays for Capote, Foxcatcher, In Treatment, and Grace Point. He served as executive producer on The Looming Tower. Dan is also an actor, director, and two-time Oscar nominee. Adam Rapp is executive producer and writer of American Rust. He has written plays, films, and series including Red Light Winter, The Sound Inside, In Treatment, Blackbird, The Looming Tower, and Dexter: New Blood. His latest novel is Wolf at the Table. He recently wrote the book for the new Broadway musical, The Outsiders.
Dan Futterman, Adam Rapp, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I've just binged season two of American Rust, Broken Justice, and I think you guys are so good at exploring the gray areas of justice and retribution and navigating the moral ambiguity of the characters. Like, we have to keep watching because we're not really sure who the good and bad guys are. Could you just set up for those who perhaps haven't seen season one, you know, where is the story at when we come into season two?
We ended on such a cliffhanger, you know, with Isaac presenting the wrench at the police station to Jeff Daniels' character. It allowed us to sort of start from a place of what's going to happen next. And I think because what is drawn in the novel and because of what Danny brought into the original script of the first season and all the ideas he brought in, we started talking about the relationship between Del Harris and Grace Poe and what is the ambiguity there? Who's essentially, I say this a lot, who's zooming who? You know, and to not ever land on one side of it, because we're all culpable in some way of being both good and bad, being virtuous and also questionable at times in our own lives. And I think when you start answering questions on either side of that too firmly, it allows the audience to disconnect from it. And then they go, oh, he's a monster or she's a monster. And then you just have this sort of a good and bad guy, good and bad woman narrative that is oversimplified all too often in our culture. So I think with the way season one was built, when we thought about season two, we were trying to run with a lot of the same ideas, even when you go from Isaac's sexuality discovery and the way he's living his life and who he's trusting and who he's giving blind faith to, down to Billy, and who is he becoming? Is he going to become, you know, someone who shoots people, or is he going to become someone who chooses love and romance? And I think we kept our North Star about where that gray area is for all our characters. And Rob Yang's character comes to mind too, Steve Park, who is driven by the truth and driven by finding justice at all costs, to the point where he becomes so self-obsessed, he becomes toxic in his own way and hellbent to find the solution to that mystery in West Virginia.
I was thinking about this and knowing we were going to have this conversation, and it felt to me like a lot of the drive of season two is about payback. There are people who feel they're owed things. They want payback. There are people who feel like they have to get back at people because they've been wronged in some way. And for Steve Park, that Adam just spoke with, there's a feeling of the justice of payback. Something was done that was terribly, terribly wrong, and he's going to right it. And in a way, every character has something, some way that they're trying to right the wrong that was done to them or that they did in the first season. I mean, Jeff is really driven, Jeff's character, Del Harris, really driven by trying to right what he sees as wrongs that he did in the first season. And he's staying a little bit away from Grace because he doesn't know how much to blame her for it. How much were his own decisions, or how much she kind of drove him to do things, like Adam is saying. So that was fun to explore. There's a lot of intertwined stories because of this. So that was a big driver, at least in my mind, and I think in all of our minds.
I think it really came across. And on that note of retribution, there is a line about whether retribution or vengeance is like a religion, almost. Like, for some of these characters, it's an article of faith and it makes them feel better about themselves.
Yeah, as we get further in the season, and I won't spoil anything, I know that some remarkable stuff happens with Billy and what he chooses to do. And I think it's around episode 8, 7, 8, somewhere in there. They all blend together in my brain now. But there's something remarkable that I can't remember how it came up in the room, but I think Danny, actually, I think you brought it up, this idea that what he does has a kind of cleansing purpose. Like the revenge he enacts gives him a feeling of cleansing so he can start over, so he can be his truest self again. And I'd never thought about that. And I thought that was a really cool thing to try to dramatize, to see a character who is kind of born again through vengeance, which is a religious idea in some way. It's a very Old Testament idea in our, you know, our Bible culture.
I think that that's right. It's at first he thinks if he just settles this issue of what he's owed, does this really kind thing for his mother in terms of buying land for her, that that will be cleansing, but it's not. And so he has to find another way to do that. You agree with that, Adam?
Absolutely. The demons are deep with him. And I do believe that he feels peace after he does what he does. And I think it's probably pretty temporary. I think the consequences of that will probably hit his life later if we're speculating.
Yeah, I'm so tempted, but I feel like I give something away, so I don't want to. But yeah, there's that line you talk about, you know, Jeff Daniels' character, Del, he says that line about, you know, I don't trust myself. So we find different people joining organizations, maybe because they don't trust themselves, but they feel that if they join a certain organization, they can perhaps see their moral pathway through groups.
Yeah, I think in my mind, at least, and I talk about this a lot because I was obsessed with this book for so long, there's a philosophical question that Raskolnikov is posing to the reader in Crime and Punishment, which is like, do good deeds offset bad deeds? And I think we see this young student in that novel trying to play a game with his soul in some ways. I feel like a lot of that can be applied to our season two. Like, if I do something right here, is it going to offset something I did wrong? Even at the end of the season, we see Grace do something that I think a lot of viewers will see as trying to balance the scales of justice in her own psyche, her own soul, something she does for Del. And all the way down the line, we always try to think about, like, what is the cost of enacting those actions? What are the consequences? And what do you get from it? And I think that was really true for most of our main cast.
Yeah, in a way, that act that you're talking about, kind of trying to earn Del's trust and love again, if it had waned. You know, I really like how you hold up a mirror but reserve judgment, whether it's on policing or politics or the oil and gas industry. And I liked what I heard Jeff Daniels said about the series. It's about good people making bad decisions. Because it's kind of like every character in American Rust knows that the system is broken and they feel like they know the best way to fix it. But, you know, we see that often their quick fixes end up breaking other things along the way.
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole fracking story, which was really fascinating to get into, I think Grace is getting into it to better her life, to give herself more solvency, to make herself feel good for the first time in, you know, 45, 50 years. And yet, even when she starts to field complaints from people who are getting their land poisoned and their animals are getting sick, she continues to press on. And we see her as being a good mother. We see her as being like a mama bear in some ways, you know, in a very moral way. And then we see her kind of acquiescing to the system of fracking and allowing some of these things to slide by. So just that storyline alone, I think there's a lot of interesting turning away from the truth in order to kind of justify or rationalize one's behavior.
We did a lot of reading about fracking. There are a lot of books and articles, and we did make a determination to not take a side on this. Anything that we read seemed to really have two sides to this. I mean, it can bring an enormous amount of economic opportunity. It can also, if you are unlucky enough to be living downstream of someone's fracking site, bring a lot of ecological problems. And yet, there's no collective decision on it. And we wanted to show that there is good in this, and there is danger in it, and just let the different characters experience that and make their own decisions based on who we felt like we'd established they were through the first season. It was a really different experience doing this second season, having felt like we really got to know these characters by the end of the first season. I don't know if you agree with that, Adam. It was different for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I felt like we could actually get into even subtler areas, especially with Billy. I felt like there was something about the trauma that he carried from his prison beat down into the new season. And we were mystified in the room about what his hard actions would be. What was he telling us? And we were just as confused in a good way about what he was going to do next. I think it offered a really interesting palette to draw new stuff for him. You know, we see him being very loving and yearning for comfort and care and friendship. And then we see when his unconscious starts to reveal itself as to what happened, we see the nightmare version starts to erupt, almost like a full-fledged PSD kind of situation. And then we see the revenge factor kind of come in. So that was really interesting, I think, for all of us. Sometimes we didn't know, and we would just say, what would you do? And I was always pushing for, let's keep digging into the I don't know, you know, because I just think that's fun to do. It probably irritated other people, but.
No, I find very watchable. And another, like we're talking about, the other theme of the series is loyalty. Like, who is your family and what are you willing to do to protect it? You know, it comes out in the lines like Del says to Grace, we all do things for people we love and you above all know it. And then, you know, it's just sometimes that they throw their lots in with the wrong family, or maybe down the line that they can see that's the wrong kind of family. And this is a question that comes up again is, so why are we sometimes drawn to those who are deeply troubled?
Well, I mean, I think you see this with, Adam was just talking about Billy, you see this with Virgil and Billy, that he kind of latches on to Billy's deeper troubles and feels like he's got the answer for how to solve his deeper psychological issues in what I think a lot of people would see as a completely insane way. But as it turns out, it may actually have been the fix that Billy needed. I mean, if we get to continue with the show, we'll explore that. Was it the fix that Billy needed, or was it not? Everybody does some projecting of what they need or want onto the people they're trying to help and love. There's nothing pure about any of these relationships. And I think you see that very strongly in the Virgil relationship. And we've seen it very clearly in the Grace and Del relationship. What do we want? What does each of them want? What does each of them need? And how do they want the other person to see them?
You mentioned earlier what Jeff had mentioned about good people making bad decisions. You know, I think when you look at Virgil's DNA, you see a charmer, you see a bit of a con man, you see a ladies' man, a Lothario. You also see a guy trying to be a really good dad. You also see a guy, you know, trying to help his community by opening a really cool bar and having fun and giving the community something that they can look forward to every night. And then we see him, you know, come close to the fire of atrocity. And I won't spoil anything there, but the thing that I like about that is you have this innocence and you have this other side of it that's constantly firing. And then it raises a question with regard to his son, Billy, is like, is it DNA? Is it learned behavior? Has Billy done enough work on his own life that he can overcome what he might've inherited from his father? And I think that's something we all look at in our lives. Like, how much of our families are, you know, we're born into our families. You can't choose your family. You know, I hear that all the time. I think I'm always amazed when I see families that stick together and wind up being friends at the second, third, fourth decades of their lives. I didn't grow up with that. I didn't see that. And I've only seen it as an adult. And it's remarkable when I see it. So I think that's something that viewers will relate to. What is this, you know, nature versus nurture versus DNA, raising all the questions of psychological and biological inheritance?
I think it's very well put.
And so, as you touched on some of course, the central love story of Del and Grace, you know, Billy and Lee, of course, there's another interesting storyline. Cynthia and Vic, again, the love that exists despite it all, and not even to mention Isaac and the Russell Wolf, that whole messed up triangle.
Yeah, I mean, I think Cynthia and Vic is a deeply troubled relationship. I think that it's not giving away too much. You see it pretty early on to say that there's something abusive going on there. And Luna Velez's character, Angela, is aware of it and trying to fix it. But they're symbiotic about those relationships. And unless somebody in it wants to get out of it, there's not a lot that can be done. And yeah, I mean, to me, that ends up being one of the more disturbing relationships in the show. He, like Virgil, can be funny. He's a terrific actor as well, Mark Menchaca. He's very funny and he's charming. And that's probably a reason that she sticks around with him. But underlying that is a very disturbed thing going on between them.
Yeah, I'll add to that. What's interesting is Britton Siebert, who plays Cynthia, when we were on set, she always wanted to talk about the darker reasons for her staying in the relationship, what she might need from that kind of a relationship. And I thought that was really sophisticated. You know, I think a lot of times those things get dramatized and you see a wolf and you see the prey. And she was digging into some of the other side of it. And I thought it made it for a very complex, honestly, a quite beautiful relationship. I think difficult and brutal. I don't like to watch that part of it. But I did believe I could see why they fell in love. And sometimes when she would gaze at him when he was charming her, you could see why she needed him. And I also think, you know, he talks about her when he's with Del and Grace in the cabin. And he says, you know, there's just something so pure and innocent about her. I fell in love with her so quickly. Something so special about her. And I know that's a limited view. And it's almost a view of looking at a child. Some of us do that. And some of us are drawn to that kind of innocence. And then we corrupt that innocence. So I thought it was beautifully executed by those actors, bravely executed. They didn't shy away from anything. If anything, they wanted to show more of the teeth in it.
Indeed. I thought you portrayed that so movingly and sensitively, because I think that there's some what people who are caught in those relationships, it may be the same reason we watch dramas. You know, like we're in these highs and lows and we get drawn in. And so it made me reflect also on Philip Meyer, because I believe he was a first responder for 15 years.
I think that you're right. I feel like I read that. And I want to say he wrote a very, very beautiful book. And it was the reason that made me want to do it. Jeff gave me the book. He'd been having trouble getting it made, getting a script that he liked. And he said to me, will you read this and just remind me what I love about it, if you feel that way? And I read it very quickly and felt that it was terrific. And there were a lot of possibilities in making it. So just kudos to Philip Meyer. He wrote a beautiful novel. And if anybody's listening and is looking for a great novel to read, there's that. And there's Adam Rapp's novel.
Yes, I want to get to A Wolf at the Table. But while we're talking about adaptations, you know, looking at both of your bodies of work, I was struck by how much your writing beyond American Rust involved adaptations. And just to list some of them, you know, Dan, you wrote the Academy Award nominated Capote around the writing of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. That's also kind of an adaptation within an adaptation. You also wrote the screenplay for Foxcatcher about the U.S. Olympic wrestling champions, the Schultz brothers. Adam, you wrote the book for the Outsiders musical, adapted from the S.E. Hinton novel and the Coppola film. And it goes on, In Treatment, adapted from the Israeli series, The Looming Tower, about the events leading up to 9/11. So, you know, from all these different perspectives, what is it like when you're working with authors who are still alive, or the challenges of telling historical events or the stories of people who are no longer with us?
Adam, why don't you go ahead, because you're doing it right now.
Yeah, with The Outsiders in particular, S.C. Hinton, Susie Hinton wrote that when she was 15 and 16. It was published when she was 17. She was told by her editors, or one editor in particular, that she couldn't have any swear words. So she was sort of forced to write about these very big, intense love and death operatic themes where, you know, there's a boy who dies by suicide by cop. There's a boy who dies from a fire. So it's about grief. His parents die in a car crash prior to all that. And there's this hugely stacked deck of grief that exists in the novel. But when you read the novel, there's a very sweet and loving tone to it. So when I started working on it, I recalled my childhood in Joliet, Illinois. My mom was a single parent. She raised three kids on her own on a nurse's salary. We grew up in a kind of rough apartment complex in Joliet, Illinois. And I remember swearing my head off. You know, I remember having a different kind of relationship to language, to the boys around me, the girls around me, to what sexuality was, what it meant to be a virgin, what it meant to be skipping school. And so when I entered, I wanted to make sure that in adapting it, because adults were going to be coming, they were going to be paying for this, you know, whether it's $100 or $200 a ticket, whatever it is, I wanted it to feel like an adult experience. So I had to give myself permission to take her great dark themes and actions that are in her novel and give language to it that was also from an adult world, kind of the world that we really live in. I'm not taking anything away from what she did, which is so beautiful. I think the reason why it was read by so many schools and classes in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000. It's 60 years old now. It's going to continue on 50 years from now. But I think she really welcomed the reader with this 14-year-old boy's voice who narrates, and it feels like you're, you know, with Huck Finn in some ways. I think with theater, you know, especially like a sophisticated Broadway show, we were really interested in the violence. We were interested in like really putting the death and the tough stuff on stage. And then also having the counterpoint of that with all the innocence and the yearning and the hope and the friendship and all that stuff. So it's firing side by side and it feels sophisticated. So I had to give myself permission, and I actually had to let her know, and we talked about it. And she's been really supportive of what the adaptation is, what the language is, with the swearing and some of the tougher stuff, and also the brutality. There's a tremendous fight scene in it that feels like it lasts 10 minutes. It actually lasts only like about 3 minutes, and it's in the rain and in the mud, and it's Grand Guignol to the hilt. It's blood and guts, and you hear fists detonating on flesh. There's no music or score to it. And I wrote that, and I was like, you know, there's a beautiful scene of that in the film, and then it's beautifully written about in the book. So I wanted to give that its full attention as well. And I'm really proud of what our choreographers and our director, Danya Taymor, what they've created for that sequence, because I've never seen anything like it on a Broadway stage, at least. And I'm excited for people to encounter the full breadth of what we're doing. But if I didn't get permission and support from Susie, I don't think I'd feel too good about it.
Yes, I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but from what I heard, for people who've had kind of sneak previews of the table reads and the musical previews, everyone has told me how moving and real and how faithful, and yet, you know, maybe just more open now that these strictures about language are, we're living in a real world now.
I think kids see so much stuff on the news. They see so much stuff on their computers. I'm shocked that I'm seeing like 7 and 8 year olds and 9 year olds in the audience with their parents. The parents who grew up reading the book are now bringing their kids to the theater. And I'm really moved by that. I think kids are a lot smarter. I don't have kids, so I'm speaking from ignorance here, but my experience being a kid and my experience being around kids, I think they're more sophisticated in terms of narrative and digesting narrative than maybe some of us give them credit for. There's a lot of really amazing librarians who all believe that. There are also a lot of very conservative librarians who want to protect kids from tougher materials. I'm really moved to see younger kids coming to the theater and seeing this very, very difficult show.
I write with my wife sometimes, Anya Epstein, who's a terrific writer. We did In Treatment together, the third season. That's actually where we met Adam. That was a kind of in-between thing in terms of adaptation. There had been two seasons, but the Israeli version, Betipul, was only two seasons. So we were sort of left to make it what we wanted and make up characters. And that was pretty thrilling.
Yes, I was just rewatching In Treatment last night, and it's so moving because you have these beautifully written scenes, say, between Gabriel Byrne's character and Diane Wiest, and to see your names side by side on the credits, just the raw emotions explored, no distractions, just people in therapy talking about love and how it falls apart and voicing those things that often go unspoken. And just to know that as husband and wife, you wrote those scenes together.
Thank you. Adam wrote a great series of sessions for the wonderful actor Irfan Khan, who unfortunately died not that long ago. And we're writing something now that's not an adaptation. It's been really freeing and wonderful to do. Each project brings with it different challenges. We had a very, very good experience on Looming Tower. Adam and I both worked on that. Lawrence Wright was kind of in and out of the writer's room, and he is just an incredible font of information. Even though the book is quite long and packed with information, he just had more to give, and contacts with all of these people, CIA, FBI, State Department, that was incredible to be able to tap into. And then there are ones that can be a little more difficult sometimes if people have very strong ideas of where they want something to go. And you just have to work as a writer within those constraints and try to find your own creativity within it. It can be challenging, but that's the job, you know, that's what you're given. And particularly in film, it's often driven by the director, and you're serving that master and trying to get your voice and your creativity into that box that you've been given. And I don't mean that necessarily pejoratively. It can be possible that the director is totally right about these things. It's just that you would have done it differently. And so trying to absorb that and then run it through your process and your creativity and put something out that feels true can be challenging.
Yes. And I thought it was amazing. I believe it was your first screenplay. They weren't, that was hidden in drawers was Capote. And I find that I didn't realize when I saw, I didn't know it was written by you when I saw the film. So, you know, for a first screenplay to be Academy Award nominated, to have that complexity, I haven't read the original book on which it was based.
It's a beautiful book. Gerald Clark wrote a biography of Truman Capote, and it's terrific. There's a very small section of it that deals with this period in his life. I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive biography. But Gerald Clark was an enormous help. He had a series of letters that he ended up giving to me and to Phil Hoffman and Bennett Miller. Bennett was the director, correspondence between Truman, Capote, and Perry Smith, who was on death row. I can't remember if there are any with Dick Hickok as well, but he continued to be a real help and kind of a godfather of the project. So that was a very good experience in terms of adaptation.
My name is Donna Sanders. I'm a master's student in English at Columbia University and an aspiring playwright. I've enjoyed listening to this insightful conversation between Dan, Adam, and Mia. I'm always intrigued to hear writers discuss the inner workings of their characters and the artistic sensibilities that inspire them to craft a particular moment or storyline. When a narrative is written with power and vibrancy, the fictional people that populate it can sometimes begin to exist in our minds as real acquaintances with real problems, hopes, and desires. This is certainly true of the characters in American Rust, who leap off the screen and ask viewers to share in their colorful life stories. Dan and Adam are clearly committed to crafting character portraits that are complex, nuanced, and impossible to pigeonhole. They do not distinguish between heroes and villains or protagonists and antagonists, but instead, they show us the many realistic ways in which our traditional codes of morality can be blurred or overwritten. I felt that Adam's allusion to crime and punishment is very much apposite. The various relationships depicted in American Rust engage with classic Dostoevskian themes like corrupted innocence and overwhelming guilt. They have a hard, bitter quality that still manages to make room for charm and humor. Only the most intelligent, well-structured works of art can successfully span this wide range of emotions, appealing at once to the viewer's pathos and to his sense of enjoyment. The Outsiders, which Adam recently adapted for the Broadway stage, is another prime example of this necessary artistic balance between deep tragedy and joyfulness. S.E. Hinton's novel has always held a very special place in my heart. Like many people, I first encountered The Outsiders around age 10 or 11, and since then it has remained in my mind and my consciousness as a model of truly beautiful storytelling. I was absolutely thrilled to see what Adam and his fellow creators did to translate this piece into a different genre, introducing new dialogue while carefully preserving the spirit of Hinton's original work. As Adam says in the interview, The Outsiders musical doesn't make any bones about violence or grit. It embraces these difficult themes and layers them alongside positive experiences of love, affection, and friendship. As I write my own plays and stories, I'm forever striving to strike a similar balance. I look to pieces like American Rust and like The Outsiders as masterclasses in the design of intricate, psychically sophisticated characters. Now, back to the interview.
Dan, on the point of interpretations or stepping into a role originated by other performers, you've done this with the film The Birdcage and on stage with Angels in America. And of course, you interpreted the life of a person who is no longer with us, as you did in A Mighty Heart when you played the kidnapped Wall Street Journal reporter, Daniel Pearl. So how do you tread that line between honoring what has come before and freeing yourself to create a distinct and new character?
For Angels in America, I had a really good model to follow with Joe Mantello. I mean, he was so terrific in the show. And it was a performance that was really working. And I'm not him, so my interpretation was always going to be a little bit different. But I didn't see it and think, I need to change a lot about this. It was like stepping into a pair of clothes that had been worn by somebody and were just getting kind of adapted for my physique. I continued to play opposite Steven Spinella for a little while. So I didn't feel like it was my place to do something entirely different. And so that was a model I really wanted to follow. For The Birdcage, it was, I mean, that was a French film, you know, so it felt very different. Elaine May had written a really different script than that. The Birdcage felt like an entirely different animal because it was a very different script than the French version. Mike Nichols and Elaine May were interested in, I think, drawing out a lot more humor than had been in the French version, which was terrific, but it was a very different kind of movie. So there was not a lot of feeling like I needed to kind of pay homage to what had been there before. And then, you know, the Daniel Pearl film was strange. I mean, I spoke with his parents, I spoke with his widow, Marianne, and all three of them were very generous. And so you do your best to try to capture what felt like people were telling you was his essence. It's also a little bit of a strange experience doing that film because I was kind of in a different movie than everybody else. It was a lot of flashback stuff with Angelina and then a very little bit with some kind of kidnap videos. And so it felt like a very different film than everybody was in. And, you know, the most important thing it felt to me was to get the relationship between husband and wife right and feeling like it was working. And, you know, I think we did. It was a different experience than the other two things.
Yes, indeed. That honoring history and also presenting in a way, because when you're in the moment, we know things, you know, like with the Looming Tower, we know things in hindsight, what happened and how do you maintain that presence?
Right, right.
And Adam, speaking of your latest book, Wolf at the Table, I'm just looking at thematic things, what unites some of your work, because you've written the pilot for Dexter New Blood. You know, it seems to be this thing about monsters are among us, but what are the families? What are the support structures that contribute to the making of a serial killer? Are these violent individuals?
Yeah, I think it all started for me in terms of being exposed to that kind of stuff when I was probably pretty small. My mom was the oldest of 13 in a Catholic family. And she had one brother in particular who was sort of the black sheep of the family and did some weird things. And he was only 2 years older than me. And he was sort of my mentor when I would go to my grandma's house. I would hang out with him. We did some questionable things. Like I saw him break into somebody's house and steal liquor. I saw him egging cars and just stuff that boys do, stupid things boys do that got a little darker and stranger later. Not that I was participating, but I learned of his story. I'm not in touch with him anymore, but that was sort of the first exposure to it. But I'll tell you, like, I grew up, as I said, in Joliet, Illinois, which is about 45 minutes south from where John Wayne Gacy killed all those boys in his home. And there was a feeling in the late 70s, early 80s, just a weird feeling that seemed to be kind of troubling the southern suburbs and southern towns of Chicago. And in the Chicago area, there was just a feeling of menace and a kind of dread feeling. And I never forgot that. And I remember also, like, around that time, I think I might have been in sixth grade, the second Halloween movie came out. And there was just this psychology of dread and killers kind of rampant. And I think that always stuck with me. And within that, you know, like I said, my mom was the oldest of 13. She was the main caregiver in her family because her mother, my grandmother, was always having children. So my mom became kind of the secondary mother. And she formed moral spines for all her brothers and sisters. And they all looked to her. My mom passed away in 1997 and she was in hospice care. And it was like watching a king die. All her brothers and sisters would just come from all over the place and just line up and want to be with her. And it was like their mother was dying. So I saw, for the most part, a very innocent person be pushed up against a lot of interesting violence, you know, violent men in particular. She was a prison nurse at Stateville Correctional where John Wayne Gacy was executed. She also was exposed to Richard Speck in 1966, like right before he killed all those nurses. She was friends with one of them. She went to the University of Chicago nursing school. She moved across the street from that townhouse the year later. She had this proximity to violence, and I find that to be fascinating. And I think it exists at a very molecular level within smaller groups than we would imagine. And I think what I was trying to figure out was, like, how does that live in your home? How does that live in your living room? How does that live down the hall from you with one of your siblings? And it was really bothering me and it's kind of haunted me. So I try to write about things that keep me up at night. So that's kind of where that was born.
Indeed. Well, you write very well about them. And even in your young adult fiction, you don't shy away from these hard truths. So just in closing, talking about the violence in American society or the way that AI or social media is accelerating this within society, as you think about the future and the importance of the arts, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Well, it's interesting. And I'd love to hear what Danny has to say about this too, because he has two daughters. I believe that we've kind of become more and more desensitized through video games, through the violent images. I mean, if you watch Apocalypse Now when you're 14 or 15, it's going to stay with you for the rest of your life. You know, it's so vivid and so real. But what happened in the like 90s when we started having first-person video games where you're charting your own narrative and you're breaking into homes and killing other opposing forces. And I wonder what that does to the brain. I wonder what that does to the system of serotonin uptake and all that. And then it sells. And then we, as a capitalist culture, we consume it and then we package it, repackage it. And then we become desensitized. And what we need to do to find the next level is we go further and further away from the original source. And look at what we have now. We have school shooters, you know, and I'm not saying that there's a direct cause and effect from the first person video games to school shooters, but I think it raises a very interesting question in our culture. And like, what can we do to kind of curb that or solve that problem? I have no idea. But I do think, you know, our capacity to ingest violent content, our permission to ingest it, has to be doing something to our brains. And I don't know what the solution is, but I think theater is really powerful because you're going to watch something, you're witnessing it, you're participating, you're collaborating. In that way, it's a political act. You're watching something that's going down right in front of you. And it can change your life. And if you have a powerful message or a powerful play and the actions are powerful, and maybe it could, you know, change the minds.
I have two daughters, and so they're thankfully not into video games or even violent films. And I feel very blessed that I like to read, which I think is a really different experience in terms of ingesting information and story. And Adam's right about theater. It's a completely different experience than much more passive experience of watching television, even film, although film, at least you're doing it with other people around. So there's something of a communal experience.
Right now, live theater is much different than looking at a screen. It's much different than looking at your computer or your Game Boy or whatever. I see grown men on the subway playing video games on their phones. And we're not even looking at each other in the subways anymore. We're like deep in a screen. And I wonder what that's done. So I think theater actually has a powerful ability to rewire us to the human experience. And maybe because of it, maybe we can find more empathy or more the capacity toward kindness.
Thank you, Dan Futterman and Adam Rapp, for your explorations of the promise and hard realities of the American dream and for holding up a mirror to the dark and light elements of our society and sharing these stories of family, love, and resilience so we may examine where we are and what we've yet to achieve. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you. Thank you very much for doing this. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Donna Sanders. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your own creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.